Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Christopher Jones Cruz, John Russell, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us another edition of America's Presidents. But first, here is Christopher Jones Cruz.
President Donald Trump made news last week when he repeated his belief that China is a currency manipulator. His comments came weeks after many observers felt that United States and Chinese officials had decided to delay action on the issue. And they were made hours after the new U.S. Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, said China would not be punished. Trump said the Chinese are, in his words, grand champions at manipulation of currency. So I haven't held back. We'll see what happens. The Reuters news agency reported the comments. The U.S. Treasury Department is expected to make a decision on the issue on April 15th. But Mnuchin may be forced to provide details of the Trump administration's plans when finance ministers meet in Germany later this month. The meeting is for representatives of the Group of 20, or G20, major economies. Many economists believe China's money, the yuan, is not being devalued on purpose, as it has been in recent years. Last year, the International Monetary Fund said the value of the yuan was at the right level for an economy the size of China's. In other words, the Chinese government was not taking steps to force down the yuan's value. Kaushik Basu is a former chief economist at the World Bank. He now teaches at Cornell University in New York State. Basu told VOA, "There is no evidence of currency manipulation by China in recent times, beyond the occasional buying and selling of foreign exchange to stabilize volatilities, which all countries, rich and poor, do. I hope the U.S. does not name China a currency manipulator, which would not be right, and would also unleash destabilizing forces in foreign exchange markets the world over." The U.S. Treasury normally uses a three-part test to decide if a country is taking steps to influence the value of its money. Scott Kennedy directs the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He said that if the Treasury Department uses the test, it will not find that China is a currency manipulator, because China meets only one of the three parts. But Kennedy thinks the administration could decide not to use the test. In his words, the ultimate decision will turn on broader U.S. policy toward China, which is still being decided. China announced last Friday it was removing Gao Hucheng as Minister for Commerce. The move came after Trump repeated his threat of declaring China a currency manipulator. China watchers are not sure if President Xi Jinping decided to replace Gao as part of the government's effort to deal with economic disputes with the United States. They say Gao may have been replaced only because he was close to the age at which the Communist Party directs officials to retire. Kennedy says the decision suggests the Commerce Minister has reached retirement age, and Xi is starting to consider the composition of the cabinet for his second term. Zhang Shan, the new Commerce Minister, may or may not stay on. The American Chamber of Commerce in China said 25% of American companies in China have moved their operations out of the country or are planning to do so. Kennedy said this is a result of worsening investment conditions in China and stronger controls on money. Jacob Kierkegaard is an economist at the Peterson Institute of International Affairs. He says that as Chinese growth slows and financial risks increase, many foreign investors will rightly ask if their investments in China continue to be justified by the, "Oh, it's a billion people, so we got to be there" factor. If foreign businesses don't make much money in China, he notes, they will stop coming.
Hind Gigi recently returned to her hometown of Karakosh in northern Iraq after Islamic State fighters were forced from the town. She and her family fled the area in 2014, just 2 hours before IS fighters captured Karakosh. They feared that IS would target them as religious minorities. So they fled to Iraqi Kurdistan without taking any of their belongings. Before IS forces attacked Karakosh, Hind Gigi was a student at the College of Medicine in Mosul. She planned to become a doctor. Gigi told VOA she was shocked at how much damage had been done to the town. The home in which she grew up was destroyed. Gigi told VOA that when IS forces fled, they took everything they could and destroyed what was left. Gigi said the IS fighters burned hundreds of other homes that belonged to Christians. They also damaged a tall religious center, the Church of St. Mary at-Tahira. St. Mary at-Tahira was once the largest church in Iraq. About 3,000 people went to religious services there every Sunday. The church is an important place for Iraqi Christians. Hundreds of people returned to the town to repair the building in late 2016. But for many Christians in Iraqi towns, life will never be the way it once was. It will be difficult to reestablish the Christian community in Karakosh and the rest of Iraq, because most Christians who fled refuse to return. They have decided to move overseas. The fleeing of many Christians has raised questions about the future of Christianity in Iraq. Muslims and Christians have lived as neighbors in the area for centuries. I don't want to live in this place again. I don't want to ever live next to people who chose to stay under IS rule, Hind Gigi told VOA. She and her family are trying to leave the country and join other Iraqis in Europe. For Gigi, moving to the West is not only an attempt to find safety, but a chance to live a better life. Like Gigi, Mariana Habash also left Karakosh with her family when IS fighters attacked. She and her family were given political asylum in France in early 2016. She now lives in Reims, France, and has begun school. Like Gigi, Habash says Karakosh is part of her past now. Habash says eight other families from Karakosh live in Reims, and more are coming. Mass Christian immigration from Iraq is harming the efforts of those who want to establish a self-governing area for Christians in northern Iraq. Romeo Hakkari leads the Beit Nahrain Assyrian Christian Political Party. He says continued mass migration of our people to the West is the greatest danger to our existence as a religious minority in Iraq. The Iraqi government does not know how many Christians live in the country, but it is estimated that more than 1.5 million Christians lived there before 2003. The Iraqi Christian Relief Council is a non-profit group that supports Christian minorities in Iraq. It says the violence that followed the American-led invasion and the targeting of religious minorities by militants have forced about 80% of the Christian population to leave the country. Hakkari partly blames the West for mass Christian immigration from Iraq. He says Western officials appealed to Iraqi Christians to live in Europe and other places. Western countries have agreed to accept Iraqi Christians and Yazidis because of the attacks by IS on these groups. This year, a State Department official told VOA that the U.S. government and Canada were working to permanently resettle hundreds of Yazidis and Christians from Iraq. Hakkari told VOA that Iraqi Christian leaders meet often with the American and European officials in an effort to reduce support for such programs. But for many Christians like Hind Gigi, it is not possible to return. I'm John Russell.
Researchers have been studying the many rocks American astronauts brought back from the moon between 1969 and 1972. The early rock studies led many scientists to think the moon was formed long ago, about 4.3 billion years ago. Scientists believe the moon was created when a huge rocky object about the size of Mars struck a very young Earth. Then some of the pieces from that violent crash came together in space to form the moon. But that estimated age, 4.3 billion years, created a problem for scientists. That is because it does not leave much time for life to get started and develop on planet Earth. Melanie Barboni is a researcher in the Department of Earth, Planetary, and Space Sciences at the University of California, Los Angeles. Barboni and other researchers at UCLA wanted a better, more exact estimate of when the moon was formed. They found their answer by studying a moon rock brought back to Earth in 1971. Barboni says they looked closely for signs of a mineral called zircon.
And we found out that the moon is actually old. The moon didn't form at 4.3 billion years old, but it formed at minimum, and this is a minimum age, it could even be slightly older, it formed at minimum 4.51 billion years old.
She says saving those extra years solves the problem of life on Earth. And this solution gives scientists a better understanding of how life formed here and how it might form on other planets. The new information means the moon was orbiting Earth just 60 million years after the birth of our solar system. Noah Petro works as a researcher for NASA. He studies the moon at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He points out that the UCLA researchers were using a single rock to estimate the age of the moon's surface. He believes that the moon is in the range of 4.5 billion years old. Lunar rocks have been studied on Earth since American astronauts first landed on the moon. They brought back more than 20 kilograms of the rocks in July 1969. The last American astronauts on the moon brought back more than 100 kilograms of rocks in 1972. There are still rocks that have yet to be studied almost 45 years later. Lunar samples are the gift that keeps on giving, Petro says. We will be studying them 45 years from now and 45 years after that. But Petro says, as much as we use rocks, it isn't set in stone what happened. That is because technology is always changing and new methods become available, providing new information from the rocks. Also, answers can be different depending on what kinds of assumptions scientists make and how the information is processed. The rocks contain truth in them. It is up to us to understand what they are telling us, Petro explains. Scientists agree that a huge object they named Theia crashed into the young Earth to create the moon. But Petro says some evidence does not really fit the model of an impact, like the fact there is water inside the moon. This means the model needs to be revisited, Petro says, and that means scientists will continue to study the moon to find more answers. I'm Anne Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Thomas Jefferson. Although he took office in 1801, he is still one of the country's best-known and most popular presidents. You can see a memorial honoring him in Washington, D.C. Jefferson is often linked to the country's history of self-government, separation of church and state, and public education. Over time, Jefferson's name also became linked to the continuation of slavery until the Civil War and to the loss of land for Native Americans. Jefferson was born in 1743 and grew up in the hills and low mountains of Virginia. His family's wealth enabled him to get an excellent education. Jefferson also learned to ride horses, dance, and explore the natural world. In the 1770s, Jefferson supported the American Revolution against Britain. He is probably most famous for being the lead writer of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson went on to hold many positions in the country's new state and national governments. He served as governor of Virginia, a minister to France, secretary of state for President George Washington, and the vice president under President John Adams. Jefferson played an important part in the creation of the U.S. But he often wrote to friends about how he most wanted to retire from public service and return to his home in Virginia. In the 1760s, he designed a house there that he called Monticello. The word means little mountain in Italian. About 130 slaves lived on Monticello's grounds at any time. They worked in Jefferson's home, farms, and on special projects, such as making cabinets and nails. Jefferson owned about 600 slaves during his life, yet he said he disliked slavery. He believed God would judge slave owners severely. And, of course, Jefferson himself wrote in the Declaration of Independence, "All men are created equal and have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Yet Jefferson used his political power to end slavery. He expected future generations would permit slavery to end slowly across the country. Jefferson's words and actions on slavery are contradictory. This conflict is especially evident because Jefferson likely had a long relationship with a slave at Monticello. Her name was Sally Hemings. Evidence suggests that Jefferson was the father of her six children of record. In 1801, Thomas Jefferson left Monticello to become the third U.S. president. His inauguration was the first held in Washington, D.C. Jefferson's government was a break from the earlier administrations. The first two presidents, George Washington and John Adams, supported a strong federal government. Jefferson, on the other hand, wanted to limit federal government. As president, Jefferson cut the national debt. He reduced the military. He disliked the power of the Supreme Court over the laws Congress made. And he rejected appearances that made the U.S. president look like a European king. One of the lasting images of Jefferson is of him receiving guests in old clothes and slippers. But as president, Jefferson also appeared strong and powerful when dealing with foreign nations. Jefferson increased American naval forces in the Mediterranean to guard against threats to American ships. And he permitted U.S. officials to buy a huge piece of land from France. Even though the Louisiana Purchase added to the national debt and exceeded the power the Constitution gave the president. In general, historians consider Jefferson's first term as president a success. Voters did too, because he easily won a second term. But those last 4 years were difficult. Jefferson's popularity suffered, especially when he stopped all American trade with Europe. Jefferson aimed to limit U.S. involvement in a war between Britain and France. Instead, critics say he ruined the American economy. Critics also attacked both Jefferson's political ideas and his personal qualities. George Washington worried that Jefferson would weaken the strong federal government he had worked hard to create. And even friends suggested in their letters that Jefferson was too idealistic. Jefferson's opponents also accused him of not being a Christian, although he said he was. However, he did not believe the government should make rules about religion. He wrote that the government should worry only about acts that hurt other people. He said, "It does not harm him if his neighbor says there are 20 gods or no gods. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." Jefferson's thinking on the separation of church and state remains important, and in general popular, in the U.S. today. However, Jefferson is linked to problems faced by Native Americans. He tried to get Indian nations to enter into treaties that ultimately took away their land. He wanted Native Americans to become more like European Americans. His policies made them depend on the federal government. And Jefferson took no major action to end slavery, either in his personal life or as a public official. At the end of his life, Jefferson wrote proudly about his accomplishments. He said he wanted to be remembered for three things: writing the Declaration of Independence, supporting religious freedom, and creating the University of Virginia. For the most part, he is. Jefferson also supported free public education, especially for those who could not pay for school. But his time at Monticello had many sorrows. His wife, Martha, had died in 1782 after difficulty in childbirth. Most of his children also died before him. In addition, the cost of improving and caring for Monticello, as well as the money he spent on fine wine and good food, had ruined him financially. Eventually, one of his daughters had to sell her father's beloved Monticello and the slaves who lived there to pay his debts. Jefferson died in his bed at the age of 83. The last detail of his life, which Americans love to tell, is that he died on America's birthday, exactly 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.